Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, July 29, 2019. Sudanese military leaders and SPLM North faction leaders reach an agreement in Juba.
We have also reached an understanding that about the issue of humanitarian assistance and intervention in the areas that are affected by war. And then also we have to renew cessation of hostilities and opening the humanitarian corridors.
And unidentified gunmen attack vehicles on the outskirts of Yei town.
The attackers were in uniforms and guns. They ambushed our civilian car and we are not happy for what has happened.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The deputy chairman of Sudan's Transitional Military Council and the faction of SPLM North Rebels led by Malik Agar signed a cessation of hostility agreement in Juba over the weekend to allow humanitarian groups to deliver aid to areas under rebel control. The two parties also agreed to free prisoners of war. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Sudanese General Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, also known as Hemeti, the deputy chairman of Sudan's governing Transitional Military Council, represented the government side, while Malik Agar headed the SPLM North side in talks held Saturday at South Sudan's State House, commonly known as J1. Daglo emerged from several hours of talks to tell reporters in Arabic that he had what he called wonderful discussions with Agar's group.
Thank God we have completed some of the agreements through this fruitful meeting, and we have reached some of the agreements, and I hope this agreement will hold and become comprehensive and will resolve some of the current problems we have in Sudan.
Agar confirmed the talks mediated by South Sudanese officials in Juba provided an opportunity for the Sudanese government and rebels to peacefully resolve their differences.
The overseeing of this process has to be done by the president of South Sudan because he has a leverage on most of the armed groups that are operating in Sudan, and these are the neighbors of South Sudan also. We have also reached an understanding that about the issue of humanitarian assistance and intervention in the areas that are affected by war, and then also we have to renew the cessation of hostilities and opening the humanitarian corridors.
Tut Galwak, President Salva Kiir's advisor on security affairs, mediated the talks between the two sides. Speaking in Arabic, Galwak says Juba got involved in the Sudanese dispute because it wants to help end the stalemate between the Sudanese military council and rebel groups.
We have reached some understanding, and hopefully this is a first sitting, and the next round of talks we will complete discussions on all the remaining issues. The first sitting was a blessing.
Another SPLM North faction led by Abdal Aziz Al-Hilu, based in the Nuba Mountains of South Kordofan State, declined to negotiate with the Transitional Military Council, but Al-Hilu's deputy Jogot Makwar was present at the talks. Makwar says his group is not ready to negotiate with the leadership of the military council, saying the military council and opposition groups representing the protesters still have many unresolved issues. Speaking in Arabic, Makwar says Al-Hilu's SPLM North faction will negotiate with Khartoum once a transitional government is in place.
We are expecting and believe that the transitional government, when formed, will be a government that will agree and bring all other parties into the system, and that will bring freedom and change. We want the military council to first finish, address the current issues with the protesters groups from the transitional government, and after that, we will then negotiate.
Douglas' weekend visit to Juba was the first of its kind following his appointment as deputy chair of the Transitional Military Council. Last year, President Salva Kiir said his government was willing to mediate differences between the Sudanese government and rebel groups fighting to topple it. He met with both sides on Saturday but did not get directly involved in Sunday's talks. Officials with the Sudanese government and rebel groups refused to take questions from reporters on Saturday's news conference. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
An identified gunman burned three passenger vehicles, abducted two Ugandan nationals, and injured two civilians in separate attacks near Yei Town over the weekend. Yei River State authorities say civilians injured in the attack are receiving treatment at Yei Civil Hospital. Daniel Friday Martin has more for VOA from Yei Town.
Both attacks occurred on Saturday. An identified armed man shot at two passenger vehicles traveling to the Mitika and Mugo markets at Payawa village, about 9 miles from Yei Town, two along the Yei Kaya Road and one along the Yei Aba Road. In the third attack, a passenger vehicle heading to Mitika Market was ambushed and burnt in Yembeb village, about 9 miles west of Yei Town. Speaking on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals by the attackers, a woman who survived the Yei Kaya Road attack says the attackers were heavily armed. Speaking in Arabic, the woman says when the gunmen who wore uniforms opened fire, she and other travelers ran into the bush.
The attackers were in uniforms and guns. They ambushed our civilian car and we are not happy for what has happened. The car we traveled in was burned down and this is not good, and we want the government to ensure the safety and security of the civilians on the roads.
The woman says the armed men abducted two of her traveling mates who are Ugandans. The gunmen also attacked two men traveling on a motorbike. 26-year-old Henry Yekar, one of the two men on the motorbike, is recovering from his injuries at Yei Civil Hospital. Speaking in Arabic, Yekar says he was heading to Kegulu along the Yei Lasu Road to collect firewood when he planned to sell in Yei Town when he and his companion were ambushed.
We were traveling for work, and after reaching Sanja Siri, two gunmen appeared and stopped us. And as we stopped, they immediately shot at us and we fell down. I heard there is peace and I am happy to move freely. I am calling on the government to be serious and security protection, because if these things start growing, many civilians will live in fear again.
Yeka says, although he was shot in the leg and lower abdomen, he managed to run into the bush and was later rescued by government national security forces. 24-year-old Simon Arafi, who was riding on a motorbike with Yeka, says some of the gunmen wore uniforms. Speaking in Arabic after undergoing surgery at Yei Civil Hospital, Arafi says the attackers shot him twice.
The attackers jumped on the road and immediately opened gunfire on us, and I was injured near my penis and also in the stomach. Currently, I am feeling a little bit okay, but my legs are too weak to move away from the treatment bed.
Yei River State Information Minister Ma Moses condemned the attacks and says all three are being investigated.
We are waiting to get a clear information, and as for now, life is normal. People should not panic. Business are going on well and people are moving from Yei to Kaya and also Lasso.
This marks the first time road ambushes have been reported on highways leading to and from Yei Town after the signing of the Revitalized Peace Agreement. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei Town.
A U.S. diplomat in South Sudan is calling on the authorities in Juba to release all political prisoners as stipulated in the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
U.S. Embassy in South Sudan spokesman Christopher Smith says in pre-taped audio that some South Sudanese have been subjected to arbitrary arrests and prolonged detentions without being charged, even though the transition constitution says no person shall be subject to arrest, detention or restriction except for specified reasons. Smith says several detained people have never had a court hearing.
Under South Sudanese law, the government has an obligation to charge defendants in a timely fashion and start judicial proceedings expeditiously. Yet when detainees in the National Security Service's Blue House detention facility seized control of the jail in protest, most of them, including Peter Biar, had never been brought before a judge.
Smith notes the 2018 peace deal is an important step towards peace in the country, but says in order for peace to happen, the government must obey its own laws.
We call on the government of South Sudan to comply with its legal obligations by informing all detainees of all charges against them in a timely fashion, or releasing the detainees if there are no charges, and to implement the provisions of the peace agreement by releasing political prisoners.
Earlier this month, Michael Christopher, editor-in-chief of the Arabic daily newspaper Al-Watan, was detained by the national security operatives at Juba International Airport. He was pulled off a plane bound for Kenya and told to report to the security headquarters the following day. The next day, Christopher showed up at the security headquarters where he tried to collect his passport and ask why he had been prevented from traveling. At that time, he was detained without a charge and remains under detention. Last week, Human Rights Watch issued a press release condemning Christopher's detention, saying his arbitrary detention is the latest brazen attack against freedom of press in South Sudan. The group called for his immediate release. Lawyer Philip Anyang, who represents activist Peter Biar, says the defense team petitioned the Court of Appeals last month and is still awaiting what is called the court's first opinion.
First opinion is the first member of the panel is looking at the appeal itself. So the first judge is looking at the case. Once he's done, he will make his recommendation or he will make his decision, then now move it to the second judge, the panel of the Court of Appeals.
Anyang says defense lawyers cannot see the opinions of the judges until a final decision is made by the court, but he says lawyers are allowed to check with the court on whether the file has been moved to the next judge. In June, the High Court sentenced Biar to 2 years in prison after he was charged with inciting an uprising while behind bars in the so-called Blue House. At the same time, South Sudanese businessman Kelbino Wall was sentenced to a total of 15 years in prison for spying, a terrorism-related charge, and for being the alleged mastermind of the October uprising. Four other men received five-year prison terms. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a former child soldier is making a difference in his village. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
would you feel disappointed if you came in second place when doing something competitive?
If I was expecting number one, then I become number two, then I'll be disappointed. Yes. If I was expecting to be number 10 or number less, then I end up in number two, then I'll be very excited.
No, I will not feel disappointed because it's a competition and it's bound for a person to win, a person to lose, and I'm better off than the third person if I should be second.
I will not be disappointed because that second, it means there will be a price attached to it. Since I am not last, I will appreciate it.
Certainly, in life, all of us yearn for success and we want to be taken first. So definitely, I would feel disappointed.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. James Touch Madier, a former child soldier, says he is determined to create a better future for himself. Touch says he is tapping into Canada's resources to provide clean water in South Sudan with his non-profit Rainmaker Enterprise, which has just built a water point in Tonch State.
Our tagline that we go with is we are building dignity drop by drop. The belief for me is that oftentimes people think that they are insignificant, that their contributions are insignificant, that they are just a drop in an ocean. But on the other hand, I believe that you are not just a drop in an ocean. You are an ocean in a drop. As opposed to people like reducing themselves to just this insignificant drop in the ocean of so many challenges that are happening.
And this initiative, Rainmaker, this organization that you founded, I see a press release here that says that it has its first well to serve 3,000 people in South Sudan.
What we are doing is we are creating full ecosystem that are sustainable, using solar technologies to supply water to communities so that communities can live healthier, more peaceful, and more prosperous. So in practical terms, what that looked like is, for example, now we just drilled the first well in Thiet County in South Sudan, and the well will be serving up to 3,000 people with clean drinking water. But more so, on the next step, we are actually installing solar-powered water pump so that we remove the hand pump, mechanical hand pump, put that in a museum if there is one, and use the modern technology to be able to increase the capacity and even bring water closer to people instead of people walking miles to come and fetch water from this single water point.
How did a 15-year-old kid from Kakuma end up in Canada and also end up being the executive director of Rainmaker? How did your story come to be?
I think my story, like some people may find something extraordinary about it. For me, I see it as an ordinary story of a human being who, you know, when tested with so many challenges, you just draw and dig deeper into yourself as an individual and know that, you know, as a human being, we have immense amount of grit and power from within that we can draw from, and that may eventually also attract the attention of the world around you to be able to collaborate with you to make the dreams that you have come to life. And I think this is a simple version of my story and my journey to climb myself out of the abyss that, you know, I went through to be the executive director and the founder of Rainmaker Enterprise.
And it's incredible to think that Rainmaker, the work that Rainmaker is doing, is impacting thousands of people at this moment.
When I was in the military training for 1 year, I knew that was one like step away from destroying villages and destroying thousands of lives. And to see a turn of events from a potential of actually destroying lives to restoring dignity to thousands of people, there's nothing as fulfilling as that.
That was James Touch Madier speaking to Ayendeng Bior from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We now turn to Australia, where a judge in Northern Territory is being accused of racism towards Indigenous defendants. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Court transcripts published in the Australian media show Judge Greg Borchers accusing an Aboriginal woman of abandoning her children while drunk in that great Indigenous fashion. He also said that anthropologists might one day discover why Indigenous parents desert their children on such a regular basis. In another transcript, Judge Borchers told an Indigenous defendant who had dragged his partner through the house by her hair that he was just like a primitive person. The comments are now the subject of an official complaint and have been condemned by the Australian Law Society. Its president is Arthur Moses.
These comments are racist because they are disparaging, discriminatory and offensive insulting and humiliating to Indigenous Australians based solely on their race.
It's not the first time Judge Borcher's comments in court have landed him in trouble. 2 years ago, there was a complaint after he told a young teenager that he was taking advantage of his mother's murder. The judge told investigators that there was no excuse for some of his remarks, but he said a heavy workload, dealing with cases involving violence and child abuse with no days off or counselling, had taken its toll. Judge Borchers has yet to publicly comment on the latest allegations. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of Australia's population, but they account for more than a quarter of prison inmates. They also suffer higher rates of poverty and ill health and die, on average, 10 years before non-Aboriginal Australians. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
South Africa has a recycling rate of just under 60%, according to industry studies, a rate that puts it on par with some European nations. But recycling is handled by a network of thousands of people who sift through garbage to identify items that can be recycled. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
It's 6 a.m. on a chilly Johannesburg morning, and Luyanda Hwatshayo is elbow deep in a trash can, pulling out milk bottles, soda cans, the lid of a pot, a broken blender. His eyes light up as he hits pay dirt, a tranche of used white paper. Hwatshayo, who is 35, has spent 9 years sorting through Johannesburg's trash cans, making him a master of turning trash into treasure. He's one of the city's 9,000 reclaimers, an informal network of workers who collect and sell recyclables. From the outside, his job looks simple. His tools are his hands and a homemade plastic dolly. But in his head, he keeps a complex agenda of which neighborhoods put out trash on which day, which roads to avoid if he doesn't want to get hit by a car in the pre-dawn darkness, and a stockbroker's mental ledger of what a recyclable item can sell for in the ever-fluctuating market. It suits his thought process, he says. He was studying banking at a local university before he ran out of money and had to drop out. Hwatshayo's job has a big impact. Academics estimate that reclaimers collect and recycle up to 90% of South Africa's post-consumer packaging and paper. In doing so, they save municipalities up to $52 million in landfill space annually. Hwatshayo says the work of reclaimers is subsidizing the municipalities.
Because an average reclaimer would collect about 200 kilograms of waste a day. You multiply that by 9,000 reclaimers, that takes it to about 2 million tons or something. That's a day. That's redirecting a lot of material out of the landfills.
Researcher Melanie Sampson has spent years studying this complex informal system, which is present, she says, in many developing nations. However, she says, reclamation is becoming a global trend.
We find reclaimers in just about every post-colonial city across the world. Reclamation exists in contexts of high income inequality, so that you have people who are wealthy enough that they're buying things and throwing them away when they still have value or can be reused, and you have people who are so poor that they are willing to go through other people's trash to extract these materials to make a living. So Asia, Africa, Latin America, Eastern Europe, we're starting to see a lot more reclaimers working in the global north.
It's grueling, messy, sometimes dangerous work. And sometimes, Hwatshayo says, reclaimers find surprises.
I found a thumb. It was. I just opened a plastic bag normally, you know, in a rush and just jumped. And it just killed my day. I just closed the bin, took my trolley, and I went home.
In Johannesburg, reclaimers are trying to organize and lobby for recognition through groups like the African Reclaimers Organization. Chairwoman Eva Makwena learned the job from her mother and has been doing it with great pride for most of her life.
My area is clean because of me. The environment, it's clean. Like the work that I do make me to be more proud. Even people, they try to put me down. But I keep on flying this flag of being a reclaimer.
Samson says her research has been eye-opening.
One of the things that I've learned from the reclaimers is what the South African economy actually looks like. Because when we analyze the economy, we're usually looking at just the formal sector, private companies, formal jobs. And yet a significant and growing number of people are generating their own income through informal work. And what I learned from them is how that informal work, particularly in the case of recycling, underpins an entire very large profitable industry. And so what it makes me realize is that we need to change the way we think about the economy.
And that, reclaimers say, is what it's all about, a different way of looking at the world. The job may look rudimentary or even quaint in this technology-driven world, but that, reclaimers say, is their core ethos. Where many see a collector pushing a handmade cart, they see a carbon-free vehicle. And where most people see trash, they see opportunity and a chance to make their world a little cleaner. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Sudanese military leaders met with a faction of SPLM North rebels in peace talks over the weekend, mediated by South Sudan. Sudanese General Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, also called Hemeti, who leads Sudan's governing transitional military council, was there, along with SPLM North's Malik Agar. The talks were held at Juba State's house. Daglo, who did not take questions afterward, called it a fruitful meeting and said the two sides reached some agreements on renewing a cessation of hostilities deal and allowing access to humanitarian groups in the area. Agar confirmed the talks provided a chance for the Sudanese government and rebels to peacefully resolve their differences. Tut Gatluk, President Salva Kiir's advisor on security affairs, mediated those talks. Unidentified gunmen attacked three passenger vehicles, abducted two Ugandan nationals, and seriously injured two civilians in separate attacks near Yei town on Saturday. The civilians who are receiving treatment at Yei Civil Hospital say some of the attackers wore military uniforms. The armed men shot at two passenger vehicles and burned those cars traveling to the Matika and Mugwo markets at Payawa village, about 9 miles from Yei town. In the third attack, a passenger vehicle was ambushed. The car was burned in Yembe village near Yei town. A woman who survived the road attack says the attackers were heavily armed. And finally, the U.S. Embassy in South Sudan is calling on the government to respect its own laws and free all political detainees as spelled out in its recent constitution and free all political detainees in the recent agreement of 2018. In a statement marking a year of what it calls the unlawful detention of peace activist and scholar Peter Bayar, the embassy yesterday urged the government to immediately release all political detainees. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
That's our show for this Monday, when I leave you with a song, Okanga, by a traditional group from Western Bahr el Ghazal. We've been listening to a traditional group from Western Bahr el Ghazal with the song Okanga. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.